Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Welcome to the Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr, and it is my pure joy to be here today, especially because of the conversation we're about to have. And that is, by the way, what I have been up to for the past 18 years is conscious conversations. They really move you forward in life by listening and hearing other people's stories. You can watch all of that on theawareshow.com. We have videos and audios for you to watch there for your constant feed of transformational media. So, my goodness, my guest today has definitely paved the way for many people to speak with and learn from her material. She has this great, I apply this phrase to her, if you want to learn something different, you have to try something different, right? And that is exactly what Ariane Duvan-Voisin, did I get it?
You did. Excellent.
That is Ariane. She is a change expert among being an author, a businesswoman, but not your typical New Thought leader. She has an MBA from Stanford. At 30, she was a star on Wall Street, running a $500 million digital media venture fund for Time Warner. She was recently awarded the TED Fellowship and is engaged in that now. She's actually talking to us from the TED offices in New York, and also has a wonderful little project, which is her four-year-old son. She wrote a spiritual children's trilogy, which is going to be something we're going to talk about soon, too. Welcome, Ariane. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Gosh, what motivates you, girl? You have been on this path for a long time. Yeah. How did it get started?
Well, you know, I grew up in five countries. I was kind of told to go do a very sort of safe route and to climb the corporate ladder and marry the right guy. And I did that for 10, 12 years. And when I was 30, 32, I sort of had the epiphany of I've climbed the wrong ladder, leaning up against the wrong wall, I'm engaged to the wrong guy. And, you know, I got down on my knees and I was like, show me the way. Like, am I really going to leave everything that the world has told me to go get? You know, and it was a scary moment, but it was a moment full of grace. And I kind of thought, you know what, I need to just trust the unknown, which is the beginning of any change. And I broke off the relationship and I left the job. And it was the beginning of a real identity shift where it wasn't about me and my life and my ego and self-concern. And the thing that had been most missing and everything was just a sense of service, contribution. What am I doing for my fellow beings? Like, why does this feel so empty? You know, I've got everything. I had the loft in Soho in New York. And I was like, wow, this isn't it. And so, I mean, to answer your question, what drives me is a sense of serving my fellow beings and just being human and being nervous and being, you know, upset and being angry and not being sure on and just kind of moving forward with the humanity part of me, which was so hidden in my previous life.
Especially in a corporate, a high-profile corporate environment, you don't have a lot of space for emotions and error at all.
Exactly, exactly. And really, it was a shift from sort of an external life to an internal life. And, you know, I'd had both. I was in the spiritual closet pretty much since I was 16. I picked up my first self-help book. I'd gone to the retreats and the seminars. But I had these, like, parallel lives. And to me, it seemed impossible that they would merge.
I get it.
Either one or the other. And, you know, I think my journey has been to sort of just be one person and just integrate it and be that in my relationships and be that with children and be that, you know, in hard business stuff. But just to not have these two versions of myself anymore, because it was exhausting.
Well, most people have, I mean, those people that have that type of epiphany don't wind up on Oprah. They don't wind up dealing, you know, at the high profile that you have created. Yeah. I mean, it's quite impressive. A TED resident. And how did you bridge that gap?
You know what? I don't think I did anything. And I'll explain that in the sense of, you know, my life was very controlled. And I used to think that I thought about something, I'd manifest it, I controlled it, and I made it happen.
Well,
and then, you know, I had a few life moments where I wasn't able to control and make things happen and bring in my beloved or have children, you know, and I was like, wow. So maybe the lesson is to not be in the control seat, not do. And I can tell you whether it was, you know, the Oprah magazine stuff and even the TED stuff, so much of that has been being very clear on my intent and my intention, which is to do good, to be a good person, to get a message out there, to raise consciousness, including my own, but then to, you know, to be visible. Like, I have to be in the world. I have to have a foot in both worlds. So I can do all the spiritual work, and I can do the trusting, the preparation, the manifesting, but I do need to be in the world. And I think those two things together, you know, where it's when you meet someone, it's more when you're ready and when your work is ready as opposed to any sort of control strategies of I'm going to make something happen.
Right. I hear you. It's can't be done from a mountaintop, and it's got to be done with congruence. You in your life have to be the same way as what you talk about. So then you found yourself, okay, there's this great, I love the first 30 days. Tell me about first 30 days. Did it arise from your experience of going from the corporate world to?
It did. So, you know, when I left corporate and I broke off an engagement, the biggest thing for me was I had such an identity which I had to kind of get away from. The hardest thing you ever change is your identity. It's not your relationship. It's not your job. It's your identity. And I thought, I actually need to get away. So I did. I left New York City for a while. And I went on this journey of meeting people and being very aware that I was going through a big life change, or more than one. And I started connecting with people around the subject of change. And I became fascinated about why is it that some people are good at change? Why do some people make changes, hard changes? And why do some people recover from tough changes? And I thought there must be ways of making change easier. It's like the number one law of life, the thing guaranteed. We've never been taught it. There must be principles of people who get through change easily.
Yes.
And I never thought I'd do anything with it. It wasn't going to be a book. I was never going to speak about it. I promise you. I did informal interviews in my journal from every person I could find. And I would ask them things like, you know, what's the best change you've ever made? What's the hardest change you've ever been through? What's a change you'd love to make? And I started seeing, I did about 1,000 interviews. I started seeing patterns, principles. People who are good at change do this. They don't do this. They don't use this language. They say this. They take this action. Here are the emotions that show up through change. You know, and then as luck would have it, I met the editor of Oprah magazine, and she was like, oh, my God, we're going to cover this and your story. And I was like, what? And then I had a book deal. And then, you know, the first 30 days came out, and then, you know, change became such a big thing, and it still is. And, you know, I think for me, it's still such a passion project for me of just showing people that regardless of what the change is, that there are ways to get through it, that, you know, the more you can kind of find the identity of you that is comfortable with change, life is not going to be so full of, like, the ups and downs and the things you hope will never happen.
It's true. And so what did you find in those interviews? What what is the – and you – and I read a little bit about it on your website. It's great to see there's – everyone experiences change. It is the only constant. What do you do in the first 30 days?
Well, you know, I sort of made myself – sort of break it down into principles because people like that. You know, whether there were 5 or 7 or 9 didn't matter. I came up with 9. But a lot of what I found was exactly what you said. We are incredibly similar. Everyone kind of goes through the same types of change, and yet we all think we're alone. I'm the only one going through this. No one else has ever felt this bad. No one else has ever made this bad of a decision. No one else has ever sat on the couch and cried or not gotten out of bed. And it's I really, you know, and that is one of the principles, which is if you are going through change, you must let people through. You must let people help. And even just having people ask for help during a change is a big indicator of when and how quickly and how well you're going to get through change, because millions of people have already gone through the similar change that you're going through. The other thing is, you know, and this was clear, a lot of people think that change is all about actions, the action of getting divorced, the action of losing weight, the action of quitting smoking, the action of starting a business. And it is, but, you know, that's actually the very last principle of the book, because so much of change is the emotional journey, and the actions of change are pretty easy. So it's the emotions are the hard part, and that's what we get sort of stuck on. You know, another thing that was very surprising to me was a lot of people say, you know, what's the one thing that everyone can do when they're going through a change? And health is the number one thing that goes out the window during times of change. Even positive change, health usually goes out the window. And people who are good at change, I kept on seeing it. They took care of themselves. They took care of themselves. You know, they were getting sleep. They were drinking water. They were exercising. They were eating well. And it's sort of when anyone's sort of in overwhelm around any type of change, it's always what I go to, because when you're in your body, then your mind kind of doesn't kind of run the show and take control, and that's the scary part. It's sort of when our mind gets very unkind. That's the hardest part of change.
Oh yes, and it can go there very fast. It definitely can. Yes. I mean, we're dealing with my mother-in-law who just had a mini stroke, and it's very, you know, it's new for all of us. And the first thing you go to is, oh my goodness, you can't talk. How is this going to change everything? And you cannot go that far forward. We have to stick with today. What can we do now? Can't go into how's life going to be different. You have to go into one day at a time because it will overwhelm you.
Yeah,
that's a big change for her, for everyone. And this happens all the time. People have massive change. And I think also a little bit, Ariana, is that the way people experience change these days are so shocking, and it's so jarring because we're already on the edge and we're already living in such a, you know, overwhelmed state. That last thing always seems to break the camel's back, so to speak.
Yeah. And, you know, there's, I always make a distinction because there's changes that kind of life does throw at you, like what happened with your mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And there are changes that life is trying to get your attention over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, one of the things that allowed me to make all the changes that I've made is really kind of tuning in to what I've now called my inner microphone, because I was an expert at turning it down to like 2, because you can never really turn it down to 0, because the body doesn't ever go quiet. And, you know, like, I live my life now by really turning that up, and it's really uncomfortable sometimes, because when your microphone consistently wakes you up in the morning and says, you're in the wrong job, you're sleeping with the wrong guy, you need to move, you know.
You want to turn that down.
You don't want to hear it. You want to keep your life in a certain way. And then, you know, life keeps nudging. And I think learning to sort of realize that that actually is my friend, and it actually is life talking to me. And we always want to, you know, for some people, deepen our spiritual relationship. And it's sort of, well, that's where it is. And it doesn't really always have to sound very nice, but there's something else. And I think, you know, change is all about letting go. And we're really bad at letting go.
Right. We want to keep things consistent. You know,
yeah. And it's sort of when do we ever learn the skill of letting go of people, things, stuff, jobs? You know, we kind of have this sense that if we're loyal and if we stay and things stay the same, then things are good. And a lot of the times, you know, as parents, I speak to a lot of parents, they do not teach their kids about change. They try and keep everything the same, same vacation, same church, same shopping, same park, same, you know, and then we come out at 16, 18 and something changes and we think something's wrong because it was not the norm.
There is no coping skills taught at a very young age, and that stuff really needs to begin early. That's the helicopter parenting has really wound up finally being discovered that it is detrimental to raising a healthy adult.
You know, and it's fascinating. I mean, with adults, like, I see over and over again, we're just, we're all so similar. Like, everyone is too busy. We don't value pausing. We don't value listening to other people or ourselves. And we do make a wrong decision. We buy the wrong house. We accept the wrong job. We hire the wrong person. We go on a date with a guy you know is wrong.
Yes.
But, like, we need to sort of value the stopping and the pausing and the inner listening, because that's where, you know, that's where so much of the suffering is.
You live in a busy city in New York. How do you do that there?
You know, it's funny you ask me that, because I've just moved back from Cape Town, South Africa. My husband's South African. And we spent 5 years there living on the beach, looking at sunsets and big African skies every day.
Wow.
And, you know, I think we both wanted a change. We wanted seasons. We wanted people. I wanted to be in a city that was full of just different races, cultures, religions, where just everything is there and accepted and beautiful. And I also wanted to raise a global kid, you know,
yeah,
who's been in a subway and seen a skyscraper and gone to a parade and gone to a march. And to me, it was important. Like, I still love it. I feel I need to have my own sort of inner practice and space. Mm-hmm. And then I can be fully functional sort of in the city. But I, you know, I've given up on all the stories about New York, whether it's too busy or it's super loud or there's no nature or there's no, you know, kind people. Like, I've dropped all the stories. And so my experience of New York is very much sort of how I want to see it.
Oh, that's great that you chose to live there. And it is an incredible city.
Yeah.
Incredible city. Now,
and, you know, to your point, like, sometimes you need to be in the madness and you need to show that you can still be calm and beautiful and functional get your word out where the people are. You know,
yes,
that's kind of what it felt for me on more of a mission place.
No, I love New York, and I love the buzz and the feeling and the energy and the kinetics and the seasons. It's all so great. It is also builds a very resilient person. Yeah, I love that you said you've given up on your stories of New York. What other things have you given up on your stories about? What stories do we tell ourselves?
You know, I think the story I've given up on myself is just where I should be by now at this stage of my life, what I should have done, what I should have made, how many kids I should have had. Like, it's just the whole should place, because it never makes me content. It never allows what's here to be appreciated. It doesn't sort of, yeah, I'm aware of, like, where there's moments of, like, unhappiness, it's usually because there's a should statement that's trying to beat me up about something. And a lot of the times, it might just not have happened yet. And
the
allowance of
mm-hmm.
time and patience, and I'm a big believer in divine timing. You know what? If a book needs to do well in 5 years, it'll be do well in 5 years. If a business needs to really come into the consensus consciousness now, it's going to, and you can't force that. That's just not willpower stuff. And I feel the more I can feel like I'm in partnership with life. So I've given up on me being the one making things happen in some ways.
That's amazing.
And there's a relief to that, you know?
Well, the only thing that I feel an urgency about is the mission, the passion that burns inside of me that says, this needs to happen now. The world needs conscious media. It needs a conversation that it can move people forward. It needs that. And maybe that's a story. I just feel like I've been given that dharma, that, not that it's only up to me, but that runs through me because I know it works. I've seen it work. I know how valuable it is in the world. I think having conversations that move and inspire people to grow and change is my contribution to the planet, maybe.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what I always ask myself is, well, how do I know how I'm doing? Is it a people thing? Is it how many people buy my books? Is it like, really, is it how many listeners we have? So I've really sort of allowed myself to look at impact in a sort of non-quantifiable way, and it's more of a feeling and a fullness as opposed to a numbers or an urgency game.
So how do you measure this is more not external measurements, which there is definitely an emphasis on how many followers and how many views and how many this, likes and so forth. you look at it as an internal experience. Now, in that case, I'm completely fulfilled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. I feel it more as, am I available to be used by spirit to be in the world? Like, mm-hmm. that's more my question. Like, am I there? Am I showing up? Am I saying yes? And then I kind of see where I'm led. You know, I was led to you, and I'm like, it's a yes. You know,
yes.
Do you see that? That's a classic example.
Mm-hmm. That is a great example. Yes, a friend of ours connected
yes.
us. So,
and who knows what we'll do from here?
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's the magic.
That is wonderful. You really get to follow the signs at that point. And you've seen it happen probably so many times, you just realize, I got to follow this.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, how did you wind up at TED? What is TED Resident?
So TED has an entrepreneur in residence program, and they choose about 20 people twice a year to come here for about 4 months to work on an idea, to incubate it here, to get resources and help. And then they give us the opportunity to do a TED Talk. And so the idea I pitched them, following the books that I've just written, was to take life skills for children beyond just books and to other media. I think it's a real, talk about urgency. Mm-hmm. There's an urgency to just help parents, caretakers, anyone who's got the privilege of being around children to protect, instill, inspire more heart-based skills, more what I call below-the-neck skills into our little tiny humans. And at TED, I'm looking at what is there in television, what is there in radio, what is there online, you know. I'm definitely not a perfect parent. There are times my kid watches stuff. But can I choose to give him skills of generosity or skills of how to deal with having a bad day or skills with how to breathe and how important breathing is to
yes.
sort of help them manage their stress and their emotions?
Yes.
So it was really following up on the Giggles and Joy books and sort of going, okay, the books are doing great, wonderful, like, what else?
Well, so it's a trilogy of three,
yes.
right now, three spiritual lessons for kids. Can you tell us a little bit about them, called Giggles and Joy?
Yeah. So, you know, they really came out of noticing that parents are absolutely trying to do their best. And sometimes we don't quite know how to instill these. We're on our own path. We're doing our own yoga, breathing, meditation. How do we teach that to a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old? So they're probably age 3 to 8, I would say. And it's humanity skills. It's emotional skills. It's, you know, everything from kindness to gratitude to telling the truth to what is home? You know, how do you deal with grown-ups? What is beauty? And they're illustrated in ways that children love and adore. And I mean, the reason I wanted to put those out is so much of my life has been around adult, you know, life
mm.
skills.
Mm-hmm.
And nearly all of our stuff starts in childhood.
It does.
And you really can trace it back. And whether it's neuroscience shows that, you know, how you're being wired up and the imprinting and the conclusions you're making about yourself or your parents or men and women, that happens like from 3 to 7. And I thought, you know, if I can give my little contribution in a sweet, beautiful way, which is the intention, in books, because we all love books and, you know, parents, that's still a skill that we're all doing.
Mm-hmm.
That was the hope.
Reading to the child, yeah. And it comes in handy when the teenage years hit, especially because those are a little bit...
Yeah.
They're very tumultuous years in terms of growing, and you've got social media as a co-parent.
Yep, absolutely.
It
yeah.
is, no matter what, it is
and it
going
needs to
be to
happen
there.
Before the teenage years in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, the world's going to impact them, and it's sort of filling up their heart, their spirit, you know, giving them skills like intuition, you know. Like mm-hmm. a lot of parents I've met, they've never even mentioned the word to their child.
Right.
You know, for us, it's very important with our son. Like, what does your intuition say? And he has a sense that there's a part of him that's there, will always be there. It'll guide him no matter what at all times
yeah.
and give him good answers. You know, so it's skills like that I feel we know, but we're not focused on enough with the little guys.
Right. And those are all self-confidence building skills, which are very needed when you come against challenges in the world and in school and in bad days and good days. It's and especially social media, when it does it's just all comparison. What are they doing? What are they doing? What are they doing? What are they doing?
Yeah.
And you have to know
yourself. This is the opposite of raising a perfect child. It's really raising a very happy, empowered, conscious child that, you know, doesn't have to meet those standards of performance. And you know, if I perform, I will be loved and approved by the world. And this is sort of a little bit of the antidote to that. The world's going to keep feeding them that message, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. So the change work that you do, the first 30 days and how much you help guide people through change, was there an app that was associated with that?
I've done two apps. One is a change app, which is a way of just helping you through while you're in the crazy waters of change.
It's a great idea.
Feeling like someone's with you, because a lot of the times you do feel alone. You're the only one who's had a diagnosis, or you're the only one who, you know, your mother has something going on. So I wanted people to feel like they have something in their pocket that's just kind of there as their friend. More recently, I did another app called Mindful 365, and that is for people who want to do the inner journey, want to do the work, but they don't have time to read 50 spiritual books. They're not going to go to a retreat. They're not going to go to yoga, and they might not even sit on their meditation cushion. You know, they are at work, busy, with parents, drinking wine, having sex, whatever, making money, but they still want to be, you know, boosting a little bit of their spirit and their heart. So that, and it's been wonderful because people who found it are like, oh my God, this is, you know, this is just a joy to know. And it's personal. It's on your phone. No one needs to know. But you still feel like you're aware, you're awake, you're being mindful in the midst of places like New York or LA.
And what is the Change app? Because I think that's still so applicable.
The Change app is quotes. It's things to do and remember. So taking care of your health, asking someone for help. It's on the first 30-day site as well.
Okay.
At this point, I think it's probably 8 years old. So I love that you found it or knew about it. But it's
that's amazing.
There, you know, that, yeah.
That you did
it's
that.
It's amazing. You know, people find things when they most need them.
Oh, I think that conversation around change and why people are good at it and why people are not is always going to apply. And I'm sure you found the same thing.
Yeah, and I love being, you know, this is one thing I do feel. I'm placed in situations where there isn't a single person you meet who's not going through a change, whether they talk about it or not, whether they bring that part, you know, of themselves to the conversation. But I feel just having a sensitivity to just knowing that people are going through tough stuff, it just makes you a bit more gentle. And sure, I have some skills to help them if it even comes up in the conversation. But I think everyone can sort of be sensitized to the fact that, you know, even if people act badly or are mean, it's probably because they're feeling bad about something.
Have you ever encountered people, and I'm sure you have, that just want to give up? And what would you advise them to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I put myself in definitely dark night of the soul category a few times where it hasn't felt like life has met you or life has taken care of you or everyone else seems to have their, you know, their thing, their idea, their person, their beloved. So I've been in that place, and you know, that place to me was necessary for something else and another part of me that needed to come through. And so I feel like, you know, the people who are at that stage, it's finding something beyond just themselves that is more important. Because when we're very me focused, my life, my body, my this, my that, that is not a fun place to be. And one of the, you know, change principles that came out was one of the ways to feel better the quickest is to focus on someone else. Someone else, something else. Who else is having a bad day? Who else had bad news? Can you send an email? Can you write a card? Can you phone someone? And just getting out of your own stuff. You know, it's just the being of service. The energy starts flowing again where it's not just sort of constricted towards you.
That is exactly. That's why support groups are so great. And there's a lot of resources available these days for making change a little bit easier. But I love yours of first 30 days and all the resources that you offer. And the people that you've interviewed, too, they've been through a significant amount of change.
Yeah.
All right.
And yeah. And I mean, it's like everyone from all walks of life, like people appear to have the perfect life, and then you hear about other things. And it's such a privilege to hear some of the journeys people have been through. Just to realize, you know, the humanity in us is, and the changes in us is actually what unites us more than what we do.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. That's a great way to say it. Well, thank you so much, Ariane Dubavance. I love the reel on here of all the people who have mispronounced your last name.
Yeah.
Ariane, good neighbor.
Yeah, that's what it should be. You know, my publisher, HarperCollins, at the time, they were like, are you sure you don't want to change your name to something else before we publish? And I was like, no, just keep it. It's going to be fun.
It's part of your story. Yes. Dubavance. Thank you, Ariane.
Thank you.
The website is first30days.com, and you can do it's 30first30days.com. Thank you so much. And I'll check in with you soon. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. I will be right back. I am Lisa Garr. You're listening to The Aware Show.